Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the ancient history podcast that aims to separate historical fact from ancient fiction. We've been flooded with love from you lovely listeners, and today we're welcoming another Patreon supporter to the Against the Law family. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon under Against the Law Podcast. The podcast team today is the perfect storm of ancient history buffs, so let me introduce them to you. Chatting about the ancient Romans is a breeze with Xenia, and just as likely to erupt into stories about ancient Greece, we're also joined by Meg. Barney will have you feeling right as rain with his knowledge about the ancient Near East, and without stealing his thunder, we have another wonderful guest today. We're joined by Dr. Jerry Toner, fellow in classics at Churchill College, Cambridge. He's written a book called Roman Disasters, which, coincidentally, we'll be focusing on this episode. I'm Flo, and I don't know much about ancient history, but I'm excited to learn with you today, listener, about ancient disasters.
My name's Jerry Toner. I look at a whole range of man-made and natural disasters, from floods and famines to warfare and earthquakes. And I'm interested in the way that the ancients dealt with all of these different stresses that they faced. I mean, in many ways, if we look at ancient Rome, for example, we think of the Romans as being tremendously successful. And yet, throughout their history, they suffered a whole range of disasters, whether it was the huge defeat at the Battle of Cannae, where they lost 50,000 men in a single day, to the destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum that we all know well. To the bubonic plague that appears for the first time in the late empire, that they face a regular bout of disasters, and yet, despite their sort of fairly pre-industrial, simple world, they survive them. And I'm interested in how they cope with disasters, how they rationalize them. But I'm also interested in what factors meant people were more vulnerable to disasters, whether it was their social status, their ideology, even the economics of the ancient world. And again, I think they all show us, in a way, what really mattered to the ancients and how they sort of understand the very difficult environment that they lived in.
I'm really particularly excited to hear about Pompeii, because that, for someone who doesn't have an education in ancient history, that's the one that stands out to me as, if I was grilled, what name an ancient disaster? Vesuvius, Pompeii, and Herculaneum definitely is what springs to mind. So, what could you give us a bit of a background about sort of like what time this took place in and what happened?
There had been an earthquake around Pompeii and Herculaneum some years before the fatal eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD. And it's clear that there had been tremors. It was building up to a larger scale event. For us, of course, it is the defining disaster of the ancient world in many ways. It's the one that has really allowed us to gain all kinds of insights into all aspects of their daily life that we don't have surviving from other parts of the ancient world. But of course, in many ways, for the ancients, what's amazing is just how disinterested they were in it. That contemporary accounts just sort of pass by it, or they barely mention it. And we have one interesting later source, which is from the historian Tacitus, which he has where he actually wrote to his younger friend Pliny the Younger, and said, look, you were there, weren't you? You were there with your uncle, Pliny the Elder. Can you just tell me what happened? And Pliny is almost kind of embarrassed about recounting these details. He says, I'm sorry that I'm giving you all these little details that aren't worthy of history. But he says it's your fault you asked for them.
I was just reading those letters earlier, and I think what really struck me was that Pliny the Younger just carried on reading his book while the eruption was happening just across the bay. That seems so strange that he would just sort of sit on the veranda and carry on reading while literally the biggest disaster of the ancient world happened around him.
That's right. I mean, it's almost as if his main priority was showing his kind of aristocratic insouciance in the face of all this great threat. And Pliny the Elder, his uncle, who is in charge of the fleet near there at Misenum, his initial response is, because he's a man who's interested in natural phenomena, is, well, I'm going to get on my boat and go out and have a look and sort of see what's actually happening, see if I can get some evidence for natural occurrences. And it's only when he gets a letter from a high status lady called Rectina, who says, come and help. But then when he's actually sort of confronted with the evidence that another very high status individual is in trouble, he says, oh yes, I must launch a rescue operation. So it gives a real insight into how our ancient sources, which are mainly from a very sort of top end of society, are really looking at disasters in a completely different way from us. They don't sort of see general human suffering. They see sort of academic interest, and they're only interested if other equally high status individuals are being threatened.
So that reminds me a little bit of hurricane chasers, particularly in the US, where you'd have a hurricane and people specifically go out in their cars to go and chase hurricanes and see how close they can get to these natural phenomena. But like you say, it's almost an unusual way of responding to a natural disaster. And I do wonder as well if, like nowadays, the majority of the people who suffer as a result of natural disasters are people from a lower socioeconomic background.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, in terms of being a disaster chaser, that's absolutely what Pliny the Elder was. And he comes a cropper. I mean, he sails too close. And his boat is destroyed by the falling, pumice and lava from the eruption. So it just highlights the danger of getting too close to these things. But absolutely, I mean, he says that he wants to launch this rescue mission because that coastline is very heavily populated, and it undoubtedly was. I mean, the population of Pompeii was something like 20,000. So there's a lot of people who would have been affected, and the number of the kind of super rich that he's interested in would have been fairly modest, even though that stretch of coastline was very popular to have a sort of holiday home if you were one of Rome's wealthy. But the ordinary citizens of Pompeii must have suffered greatly. It's an interesting thing, though, that even though we think the population is about 20,000, there's only about 1,000 bodies have been found. And even if you sort of allow for the fact that many others will have been escaping, might have got outside the city, and so their bodies haven't been discovered, it probably seems unlikely that more than 10% of the population actually died. Which is interesting in that it probably suggests that most of them were fairly sensible. You know, when they could see that the mountaintop was smoking, when they could feel tremors and groans, they just, you know, picked up their stuff and walked away. So we shouldn't imagine that the ancients were all kind of sitting there paralyzed in the face of these sort of potentially disastrous events. They could actually sort of do things about them.
I'm going to throw a question out to everybody on the podcast. I want to know specifically about how people felt about natural disasters and whether they applied any supernatural causes, maybe.
I mean, when you look at the variety of interpretations ancients have for why disasters happen, you do get some more academic answers. So Seneca, for example, talks about earthquakes being caused by caverns under the earth that are full of gas, and that when this gas sometimes catches light and that causes the earth to tremor, or the flames burst through the air as volcanoes sometimes, and that's building on an old Aristotelian concept. So there are these kind of more academic-y understandings, but for the most part, people interpret disasters as signs sent from the gods. And clearly it's not a sign that the gods are happy, it's a sign that the gods are very unhappy. And then it's a question of the ancients trying to understand what it is that is making the gods so unhappy. And that leads to a very common response, which is one of increased ritual activity, that you obviously start having all kinds of attempts to placate the gods. But it also means that you often try and find a scapegoat. you try and find out exactly what it is that is upsetting the gods. I mean, this is where in the early empire, the Christians often fall foul of the Roman state. So, for example, when there's the Great Fire in Rome in 64, Emperor Nero initially actually tries to help the people of Rome. He opens up his palaces and gardens for people to take shelter in. He hands out lots of free food. But a rumour emerges that he has started the fire, and it's as if he needs to find a scapegoat to take the heat off himself, as it were. And he picks on the Christians. Now, that might be because this was a group that were sort of quite widely known about, but people were hostile to them because they had such a strange set of religious beliefs from the Roman point of view. Nero focuses on them as a group that he can plausibly blame for the fire, and he has numbers of them either crucified or burnt or thrown to the dogs. And it's an easy way for an emperor to just push the blame away from himself.
And I suppose going throughout history, Meg, do you have any stories from ancient Greece about perhaps supernatural causes?
Yeah, I was just going to say it is interesting. It's very similar in that, like, there are some sort of scientific explanations or, like, quasi-scientific explanations, but then also you've got the divine retribution as a cause. And I think it's kind of parallels. We talk quite a lot about, like, in our medicine episode and stuff like that, about the sort of movement from the gods as the cause of illness to, yeah, a more kind of bodily, physical explanation for that with Hippocrates. And it's kind of like that. There's sort of the gods are always, to some extent, seen as being involved. But there's a really interesting, there's a philosopher called Thales of Miletus, who said that the earth is a ship on the ocean and the waves of the ocean cause the ship to sort of tremble, which I think is interesting because it's sort of, it's obviously not correct, but it's sort of hinting at the idea of, you know, something happening underneath the earth which causes problems. So there was sort of some understanding of it, but yeah, definitely gods involved as well. There's an earthquake in Sparta in the 5th century BC, which is interpreted as being divine retribution for an apparent kind of sin committed against some of the enslaved people in Sparta, which is interesting.
Absolutely. I think the kind of divine cause that they attribute to disasters is not always a kind of great design divine cause. You know, we might imagine that it's always like an omnipotent Christian god. Some of these gods or divine powers are fairly sort of modest, and so you get what we might almost call local disasters. So villages being trashed by a sort of a tidal wave or something, or a plague of locusts or something like that. And they interpret this as being some sort of small local demonic powers having been released from, you know, under the ground somewhere and needing to be driven back. And it's something you find particularly in actually later Christian sources, that one of the things that holy men do is very much sort of turn up in villages and drive these sort of little demonic powers back into their place.
It's so interesting, isn't it, that I really like that idea of sort of local disasters, but it can also be, I'm thinking about like the beginning of the Iliad, where the Greek army is sort of struck down by a plague, and like that's caused, you know, God Apollo, like that, and it's a terrible plague, but again it's like it's retribution for a very specific single thing, which is that Agamemnon has taken as his sort of slave girl the daughter of one of the priests of Apollo. So it's very much like, it's not that sort of thing you get in other myths, like maybe we can talk about flood myths in a minute, where, you know, I'm punishing the whole world. It's very much like that guy did something annoying and therefore I'm sending a plague. So is it, that's interesting again, isn't it, that kind of difference between like local and global.
There's a lot of parallels I've been learning as we've been doing this podcast between sort of cultural sort of beliefs of Romans and Greeks. Quite often they'll almost seem to borrow from each other, but I'm quite interested in seeing if anyone in the ancient Near East attributed natural disasters to the weird and the wonderful and supernatural and divine retribution. Barney?
Well, I've got a very maybe flighty reason that a god decides to strike down the entire population. Possibly harder to justify than some of the like grand sins that you might expect for other divine causes for these things. But a bit of background first, because this is sort of like the mother of all disasters in the ancient Near East. And in a sense, in our modern world as well, since the Judeo-Christian tradition is so strong, which is, of course, the flood myth of the Bible and Noah's Ark, which people may or may not know can be fairly easily traced back to ancient Near Eastern origins. And so there's a variety of flood myths in the Babylonian and Sumerian canon. This particular divine cause is in the Atrahasis myth. And the gods in that are annoyed with the amount of noise that humans are making. So they decide to strike down the population of the, you know, the entire world.
I see they've met my neighbours then.
Exactly.
Just an incredibly severe noise.
Yeah. Get the council round. No. Enlil.
Yeah. The flood.
But yeah, so Enlil is persistently annoyed by how much noise the humans, you know, down below are making, and he sends a number of different disasters, famine and drought, before finally resorting to the flood. But it's interesting because even, you know, this is a myth and it's not any real natural disaster that's necessarily being referred to, or at least that has fallen out of fashion, trying to find, you know, archaeological evidence of the biblical flood. But what's interesting is that, you know, humans making so much noise that they annoy the gods kind of smacks a little bit of like overpopulation and overcrowding amongst the humans. And so, yes, this is mythical, but there's an interesting kind of that human element in there as well, a kind of a recognition that lots of people in a small space might not necessarily be the most productive thing.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the flood stories just show perhaps the importance of flooding in the early history of mankind and how it develops. That one of the things that floods do, I mean, they can be beneficial, you know, things like the Nile in Egypt, that a regular kind of inundation actually allows some proper irrigation and much greater fertility that is pretty regular. But when the floods are slightly out of control, it obviously is a potential disaster that actually forces some radical adaptive behaviour. I mean, you've got to start sort of thinking about where can you actually go and congregate safely together. So there is an argument that actually it's the kind of disasters that sort of force people into more concentrated communities and actually leads to, you know, what we think of as urban life. In a way, it may be that floods are key at forcing humans into a more sophisticated kind of agricultural and economic behaviour that ultimately leads into sort of early urban life.
That is so interesting. Yeah. The Greeks have a flood myth as well, with like Deucalion, who's the sort of the Noah of the situation, who is Prometheus's son, and he's sort of saved from the big Greek flood by building a chest and escaping with his wife. He doesn't take any animals like Noah, he just gets in his chest. But that flood, again, like Barney was saying, this sort of, you know, is all conjecture to link myths to real events. But that flood, it has been suggested that might reflect a kind of cultural memory of the tsunamis that probably happened after the eruption of the Santorini volcano, which was an absolutely massive volcanic eruption in about 1600 BC, where on one of the islands in Santorini. And it was, you know, completely catastrophic. It was one of the biggest volcanic eruptions ever in all of history, and really must have changed, you know, must have hugely changed the kind of social, geographical, you know, everything landscape of what was at that time the kind of Minoan civilization. But yeah, there have been suggestions that some myths kind of hark back to this idea of sort of total destruction, tsunamis, volcanoes. Even Atlantis has been linked to possibly, you know, a city that was buried by the flood after the volcano.
Absolutely. I mean, we should remember that eastern part of the Mediterranean suffers from quite a lot of earthquakes. I mean, not all as large as the one you describe. So you're going to get a whole variety of sort of quite modest tsunamis. And later on, we have descriptions, say, in the 4th century historian Ammianus, where he describes a tsunami where the sea is kind of first sort of disappears, you know, it's all pulled back and then inundates the land when it comes back. So it's you can imagine that with the Greeks being very much a kind of maritime people, as it were, very much living off the sea, living close to the sea, that kind of quite regular occurrence of tsunamis of different sizes will have had a real sort of impact on their collective psyche. It's the big disaster that you fear, the one that you're always trying to sort of keep the gods from inflicting upon you. You never know when it's going to come and hit you, but you probably know that at some point it will.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, for the Minoans, this eruption was, you know, it used to be thought that it was actually the thing that kind of caused their ultimate downfall. That was a theory for a while. And now, like, recent evidence has suggested that actually the eruption was quite a long time before Minoan civilization fell. But they were like a maritime society, so it did have a huge impact on them, this volcano and then tsunamis. And it probably weakened their society, leading to the sort of change from, like, the Minoans into the Mycenaeans, which is, again, that's sort of the journey into Greece as we know it. So that volcano, you know, really changed the course of human history in that sense, if it did make the Minoans vulnerable.
I mean, I think it's quite interesting to contrast it with what we were talking about earlier with the eruption at Pompeii.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that has no impact. The Romans,
yeah.
The Romans just forget about it. I mean, a few people come back and try and sort of dig down and recover some possessions. But agriculture actually soon returns. If anything, it's quite good for the sort of fertility of the region.
I actually find it quite interesting, Jerry, since you compared, you know, those larger scale eruptions to the fairly low impact Pompeii, to think about how cascading some of the effects of larger disasters in the ancient world could have been, and how often that's when you get sort of, you know, natural phenomena interacting very much with human elements, and how human behavior can sometimes exacerbate these disasters. This isn't strictly ancient Near East, but I've been reading quite a lot about the Indus Valley civilization recently. And I think there's a fairly compelling case that some of the reasons why that culture declined is partly anthropogenic, because they were deforesting? Is that the verb? Performing deforestation.
Yeah.
They were deforesting. That sounds weird. I've never said that before.
They were cutting down a lot of trees,
leading to mass deforestation. Yeah. So the Indus Valley civilization cut down a lot of trees, you know, partly for stoking fires to make bronze, for example. And obviously that has an effect on the damage on rainfall, and then on droughts, which can cause to famines. And so, you know, when thinking about natural disasters, I think sometimes it's important to identify that human behaviour can have an effect on the severity of these disasters as well.
Absolutely. It's where the kind of division between natural and man-made is often sort of a false one. I mean, if you think in the modern world and at places like Bangladesh, you know, it's poverty that forces people to live in riskier areas that leaves them more vulnerable to a flood when it happens. So in a way, it's only the fact that people are in the wrong place at the wrong time that a disaster happens. Otherwise, it would simply be a physical event like a flood. So it's, and you do see that in the ancient world. I mean, you see heavy deforestation because the Romans, for example, have a big need for timber. I mean, for shipbuilding, for metal working, and actually ice core samples that have been taken up near the North Pole show evidence of pollution. I mean, that coincide with the Roman period, because they were just producing a lot of what we would call sort of greenhouse gases. Obviously not on a scale to generate the global warming that we have, but it was enough to have a serious impact on the environment that could degrade parts of it to an extent that then left people living in a place where they were more vulnerable to any adverse natural occurrence.
It's one of the sort of theories for, like, the Bronze Age collapse as well, isn't it? That there might have been natural disasters or a series of natural disasters like earthquakes or famines or drought, which might have then prompted kind of mass migration, leading to, you know, clashes between societies and civilizations. So that's, again, the mixture of humans and the natural world. It's interesting.
Yes, I mean, an example from the other end of the ancient world. I mean, it's generally thought that the Huns move from their nomadic lifestyle in the sort of central Asian steppes, possibly because of a environmental change that just means they're unable to feed their flocks, and so they move westwards. And that, of course, you know, then pushes other tribes westwards, and it pushes them eventually into the Roman Empire, where they're looking partly for security, and they want to settle within the empire so that they're safe from these terrifying Huns. Now, it's not, you know, there may also be some political reason for why the Huns moved, but it's clear that large-scale environmental change can fundamentally change human behaviour, and it can force them to move, and that creates real clashes.
I agree, and I think also in situations like that, it's interesting to reanalyze, you know, the narrative of, say, the Huns moving into Europe, or in the case of the Bronze Age collapse, the Sea Peoples moving into Egypt, as not necessarily the narrative of, you know, the powers in those areas who were suffering from the invasions, but to see those people migrating as potential victims of disasters back home, as it were. Because, you know, the Egyptians, in the case of the Sea Peoples, who are this sort of mysterious conglomeration of invaders from overseas who sort of lay waste to the Egyptian New Kingdom, they're very much the enemy. But, you know, if people accept that, yes, there might have been droughts, earthquakes, whatever, that caused them to leave their homelands, then they can be seen sort of as victims rather than strictly invaders.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's something you see in the modern world today. I mean, think of Syria, for example. I mean, the dreadful conflict there has resulted in large-scale migration, which has created all kinds of political tension in the countries which has been on the receiving end of it. So it's that kind of mass movement of population is always going to completely upset existing social orders. But equally, you can see how often it's going to take a very significant prompt, you know, something like a disaster, to force a people to get up and move. You know, if things are going fine, then why move? You know, it's disasters and that kind of pressure that they generate is arguably something that has really been a driver of human history and progress, that humans are forced to actually accommodate themselves and react to and cope with these enormously stressful events.
Jerry, I'm going to start with you. What was your favourite thing that you've learned from today's episode or talked about today?
I think what's really become clear to me is just how disasters can be seen as almost having a positive impact on human history and progress, that clearly they're dreadful events when they happen, but they have often acted repeatedly through the ancient world as spurs for humans to recover, and they're in a way give a positive message of human resilience. And given we face all kinds of threats, you know, and at the moment from pandemics to environmental threats, perhaps gives me hope that we can respond to them and recover from them.
And use them as a catalyst for positive change. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting viewpoint. I'm going to go to you, Barney. Barney, what was your favourite thing from today's episode?
So my favourite thing is an image that's sort of seared into my mind. As I guess there's a bit of irony in it as well. As Pliny, the original storm chaser, you know, taking his boat off into the eye of the volcanic eruption and then being struck down by the falling lava and rocks. Yeah, it's a bit of irony in there, and my favourite thing today.
Very dark image, but also darkly humorous. Now we've got, you know, a few centuries between us. I think that's, yeah, perfectly acceptable to find amusing. Senya, what was your favourite thing from today?
So I really liked Meg's suggestion of like how the effect of the Santorini volcano was so powerful on that kind of Greek psyche that they tried to explain, I suppose, yeah, the traumatic effect that had had on the very fabric of their society. through this mythology of Deucalion and what was his wife called? Pyrrha?
Yeah, Pyrrha.
I think that's really powerful.
And even if it's not the, you know, even if it's not specifically responding to the Santorini eruption, I think it's really interesting just to think about how many of the sort of myths reflect fear of the natural world or of things out of you know, their control. So even if it's not that specific one, it's still kind of, yeah, it represents that fear of the unknown and everything. It's really cool.
So hopping over to you, Meg, your favourite thing.
Oh, well, I'm annoyed that I let Barney go first because my favourite thing was also the idea of Pliny as the original storm chaser. I just think that's so interesting. That kind of, it's such a classic story, isn't it? Like someone, yeah, like you were saying, that someone flying too close to the sun, sort of going too far in their pursuit of knowledge. It's like in Frankenstein, you know, like Captain Walton going to the Arctic and obviously Frankenstein doing his thing with the creature. But I will choose a new favourite thing, which is, I found that discussion of the kind of different ways we respond to ancient disasters with either, you know, the physical impact on the buildings or the emotional impact on the society, or like Marnie was saying, just trying to prove that they happened. I found that so interesting, those kind of different approaches.
I am so thrilled that no one's gone for my favourite thing, which is the flood myth that Barney shared about a flood being caused by humans being too noisy. And I just want to know, where were those deities when I was living in a flat and had both my upstairs and downstairs neighbours apparently learning how to do the can-can 24/7. I think yeah, absolutely fantastic. Well, thank you for an amazing episode, Jerry. I really, really loved this discussion today. It felt like it was, I learned a lot about natural disasters in the ancient world.
Great. Well, thanks. It's been a lot of fun. It's a great pleasure.